This is Sidepod Chat. You have thrown a spanner in the works.
It's 2011, and although we promised to speak to Nisha in 2010, again, after our initial inaugural Sidepod Chat, and we ran out of time, unfortunately.
We're always late.
We're always a bit late, but it's 2011, and the season hasn't yet started, for various reasons. And we've managed to squeeze in a chat, and on the phone right now, I believe, we have Mr. Manipev One himself. Hello, Nisha.
Hello, how are we doing?
I'm fantastic. Yourself?
Brilliant altogether.
Good.
Fantastic.
I'm always paranoid about my pronunciation. Did I get it right this time?
You did, yes.
Woohoo! Christine didn't speak to you. I don't think she was on the chat last time.
No, so that means this one will be better.
We may hold you to that at the end of the show. We will come back and review this and find out whether this show was actually better. I believe we're catching up with your good self, coming on the back of something of a victory. Is that right?
That's correct. A victory for all Irish people, you could say.
Tell us more about what's been going on today and why it's so significant.
Well, my knowledge isn't the best, given that I'm not too big into cricket, but the Cricket World Cup is on at the moment in India, and Ireland played England today in a kind of a group match, so one of the first games that they had, and we beat England, which is pretty amazing.
So we're the losers then in this...
For once, yeah.
I didn't know Ireland played cricket.
To be honest, I didn't know much about it either.
You'll take any victory as it comes, though, right?
Exactly. We're very patriotic people, the Irish, so we win together and we lose together. And the country is on a high at the moment from the win. You know, given that it's an English sport, so kind of beating at your own game, it's always good.
This is a brilliant, by the way. I love this introduction to a podcast. This is Formula One fans talking to other Formula One fans, neither of whom are particularly clued up on cricket, but both are keen to talk about it regardless. I know nothing about it, but I'm interested to learn.
You're both keen. I reckon we should talk about Formula One now.
Should we do that?
Yes, sounds good to me.
Okay, let's talk about something you are familiar with then. Formula One and journalism. It's one of our favourite subjects, actually. And you have thrown a spanner in the works of internet publishing this year. You hinted that you might do such a thing at the end of 2010. And is it from the beginning of 2011 you've changed this approach, or is it just during the off season you've made this change?
On the 1st of January, I do kind of update my website once a year. Instead of doing things kind of ad hoc every now and again, I target my changes for the 1st of January every year just to have something to aim for. So I decided this year, instead of publishing news as it happens and when it comes to hand, to do it the old-fashioned way and just publish it once a day. So every morning at 8 o'clock, Irish time or British time, same thing, the news goes up. But in order to keep it kind of relevant, that publishing time will change over race weekends. So, for example, the Australian Grand Prix, it would be kind of pointless to be publishing Saturday's news on Sunday morning at 8 o'clock when the race is already finished. So that 12 publication time would be 8 o'clock relative to the Australian time zone, and then it would change relative to every race just to make it more current.
Okay, so you've put quite a bit of thought into this by the sound of it. What led you to make this change?
To be honest, when you're kind of in the middle of it and you're doing news when it happens as it happens, when it comes in and everything, you kind of lose sight of the objective. You're just doing it for the sake of doing it. I mean, when I looked at it from a different angle, I mean, you can see easily that the quality of Formula One journalism on the internet is quite appalling. I'll give you kind of one little comparison, so to say. Farooz Fawzi was confirmed at Lotus Renault, I think it was January or something like that, fairly recently. And I think 99% of the reports that I read on the internet about him was simply Farooz Fawzi joins Renault as test driver. There's a quote there from Farooz, and there might have been another quote there from Eric Boullier, the team principal. Now, if we were to take that kind of an attitude over to the political world, say, and if a minister were to resign from the government, let's say, the F1 journalists on the internet attitude would be, you say Minister X has resigned, replaced by Minister Y. Here's a quote from Minister X, a quote from the new Minister Y, and maybe another quote from the Prime Minister.
Okay.
But if you were to read a genuine publication such as a broadsheet newspaper, you probably, the Guardian is probably the one there, the Times in England, it's the Irish Times over here, you'd get a story about why he was resigning, why the new person was coming in, and the backstory and everything, and you'd probably get one or two quotes that don't really matter at the end of the day, because they'd have to come in from a press release, which is the government feeding information that they want you to give yes. out to the public.
Yep.
So going back to the Firouz Fawzi story, I mean, anybody who knows anything about him knows that he's not a worthy driver for Formula One. I learned last year at some stage that Firouz's dad was a business partner of Tony Fernandez, and obviously Firouz was an employee of Lotus Racing beforehand. So it got me thinking, and I said, okay, this isn't what it seems on the face of it. So I did a little bit of digging, and I called around a few people, and you know, it became quite clear that this was not an appointment for the sake of it, and that it was a political appointment as much as anything else, given that the Malaysian government own Proton, who own Lotus, who are a partner in Lotus Renault GP.
Gotcha.
So when I wrote my report, I said Firouz Fawzi has signed for Renault as a test driver, but this is a political appointment, basically, is what I said. Now, no other publication did that on the internet. They said he's been signed and he's going to be the test driver and all that. No mention for why it's happened or the backstory or how it came about or anything like that. Now, if you were to open Autosport the next week, you might have seen that kind of a thing. But I understand why the publications on the internet do that they just write basically a story from the press release, because they don't have the time. They have to throw the story out straight away. So that's part of the reason that I went to the Once a Day publishing. I mean, it gives me a chance to, gives me an extra couple of hours and not as much pressure to be able to research a story properly before going to press. You know, the publishing stories at 24 hours a day as it happens, when it happens, is good in one way for the fans, because they get news straight away. It's the same kind of thing on Twitter, you know, it's straight from the racetrack, within seconds from when it happens and so on. But it doesn't lead to quality journalism. It leads to very poor journalism, in my opinion. Now, you could, if you had the right attitude and if you had the right contacts and everything, you could stick with the constant publication when it happens, as it happens. But there are no internet journalists out there, bar Autosport and BBC and one or two others, that have the contacts to be able to do that. And, of course, you could question whether they should be doing the, you know, a constant publishing when it happens, as it happens, not giving them time to research stories properly. But usually they're so good that they'd have the research done beforehand, and they'd have the story. They know the story coming along down the track, so they'd be able to preempt the publishing or the announcement itself.
I'm not sure Autosport do that, though. I mean, even if they had the capacity to do it, I don't get from reading what they do that they have stories prepped in that manner most of the time. I got the impression from a recent, I think it was the Infinity story, they managed to, I think they got three stories from one press release, and then a couple of days later, they had a feature in. So, I mean, from my understanding, you're writing feature posts and analysis, which is sort of after the fact, now that you've had time to digest the news, and you've got all the facts together, and here are your thoughts on it. And what you've stopped doing is immediate, this is the news as it happens. And I sort of get the impression that even if Autosport had the capacity to do what you're suggesting, they're still doing the former and then later coming in with the latter analysis. They're not doing analysis as it happens.
Well, Autosport do have very good journalists. I mean, Ed Straw and Jonathan Noble are superb. They've got fantastic contacts, and they know exactly what's going on all the time. But I mean, they can't be working 24 hours a day. Autosport have other journalists doing the work as well.
Right.
Other journalists that aren't so good. But I mean, I wouldn't at all question Ed Straw or John Noble's ability or charisma or anything like that. They're well up to date on everything. They would be two of the best journalists in Formula One. But they are being kind of constrained by the 24-hour news cycle thing. I mean, it is very constraining. There's not much room for manoeuvre. So I've tried to break out of that mould. I mean, another thing is that you probably I mean, stories develop so quickly that within one day you could have three or four stories on the same subject. Whereas with me, it's one story summing up everything instead of having to read four different stories on the event developing over the course of a few hours. You can come to MNIPF1 and read the comprehensive story in one, which, you know, it doesn't include, or it shouldn't include, you know, false leads or anything like that, because the story had time to develop over the previous day.
So what you're saying is your new method of working is quality over quantity. So you've got one story per story, and you're not tracking that. You're not tracking events as they unfold throughout the day.
Well, it's a matter of giving out the... Obviously, I would be tracking the story over the course of the day, but I wouldn't be writing about it. I'd be learning about what's happening and keeping myself up to date and everything. But then when it comes to telling the fans and my readers what's going on, you know, it's a waste of time to be... I would consider it a waste of time anyway to be reading something and then 2 hours later having to read something else that contradicts, so to speak, the previous story. Wouldn't it be better just to read one story that you know is correct and that is fact and won't change monumentally in the next 5 hours? Go on.
Well, it just occurs to me, I mean, the kind of model that you... I mean, you did this before The Daily came out, but have you heard about The Daily newspaper, which debuted on the iPad from Rupert Murdoch?
No.
Basically, it's a similar concept. It's... what they do is they produce a newspaper that comes out every day, but instead of being in paper form, it's online. So they collect all the news up, write proper analysis, proper features, pull it all together in a nice format, and then release it and download it every... I think it just comes down every evening, so it's available for you to read in the morning. So it's a similar thing to what you're doing. It's general news, it's not Formula One news. Yes. And you did it first. You did it in January, and this has only come out in mid-February, so...
I must be copying me, so...
Yes, absolutely. That Rupert Murdoch, he's obviously... You could be onto something. So what do you think you've lost as a result of doing what you've done? Have you seen your web traffic change? Have the responses in your forum been different in any way?
Not particularly. As regards to traffic, I think it's actually... The short term has actually gone up. It's a much more consistent and reliable service. You know, you can come to my site every morning at 8 o'clock and you know there's going to be something up there. I think there's been only 2 days in the first 2 months that I haven't had news up. What one was because we had the election in Ireland at the weekend, so I was kind of glued into that for 48 hours. And I think the previous time there was just no news, so I said that there's no point publishing something when there's no news. The vast 99% of the time there is going to be something there to read, and you can come back every morning at 8 o'clock and there's going to be something there, instead of having to go back to like you do to other websites and keep on looking every half an hour, an hour, whenever it is. So it is a more reliable service, and I think that's something that appeals to people.
From my point of view, you say that I will turn up at 8 o'clock in the morning and something will be there. You're assuming that I'm awake at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Well, whenever you wake up, I mean, you check it once a day as opposed to 20 times a day and then checking it and there's nothing new there or whatever. There's always going to be something to read when you check it once a day.
It sounds like a great concept. It works for me, I have found it on occasion, if I've heard, I might have already overread a story. If I'm particularly following something of interest, and I followed it on Autosport, and I followed it on Twitter, and I followed it in the various places, when I come to the next morning, I find it in my RSS feed from your site. I may skip that because I know everything there is to know about that. So, from my point of view, I think it's great that you're doing the analysis, but I also worry that possibly I'm overlooking some things. You may go into more depth, but because I sort of feel like I know enough about the story, I'm almost overlooking it. And going, okay, well, I know that, so I'll just skip over that story.
That is a major challenge, all right, and the way I'm going to tackle that is just by giving the inside stories, such as the thing that I did with Feroz Felsi, giving the reasons for why he was appointed. Because if you read that story on any other site, as I said, it was just taken directly from the press release that he was being appointed the test driver. And maybe some people might have done well and written about his GP2 background and his time with Lotus Racing last year. But I mean, I didn't read anywhere that it was that he was a bad driver and that it wasn't based on performance that he was being appointed. I mean, it's all about money there.
I'm curious what Christian thinks on this, actually. But from my point of view, I think that general instant news, whereby you get a press release and you get a quote and it comes out straight, comes out instantly, I think that has value. And I do like that sites do that. And I am interested to see what's in the press release. And I know that Autosport have the ability to split one press release into multiple posts, but I do like to say to see what the inside line is as it's being told.
You have to be careful. The inside line, the press releases that come from the teams are very carefully scripted. They're only telling you what they want you to know.
Yes, but what I'm saying is I want to know what they want me to know. Do you know what I mean? I almost want the press release in its raw form so I can read exactly what angle they're trying to run before I read what people think about it.
Well, in that case, everybody would be looking at 12 different teams sites every day and not bothering with the with news websites. Because, I mean, I think it's said that there's a good journalist here in Ireland called Shane Ross. He's been doing lots of things about the banks and writing about the corruption, so to speak, that's in the political system here. Hmm. And I remember he said once that a journalist's job is to tell the public what the powers that be don't want the public to know. It's the same kind of thing with Formula One. The teams are sending out a certain story, but there's usually another story behind that, and it's a journalist's job to find out what that other story is and to tell it to the fans and the readers of the various websites.
I mean, just to throw this to Christian as well, I'm curious, this kind of feature analysis that Manipe's talking about. Can I call you Manipe? I feel like I just need to call... To me, you are ManipeF1.com. That's what I call you.
That's good. Yeah. I've been called Manipe for many, many years.
The thing that Nisha's describing, to me, it sounds like it has value that you'd always pay for it. We pay for Autosport Plus, and that's essentially what you're getting every single day. That has a certain amount of value, right?
Yeah.
Would you pay for that kind of insight?
Most likely... Yes, I think as long as you know it's going to be regular, it's going to be more insight than just a quote here and there. It's the kind of thing that has value.
Is that in your roadmap at all, Nisha?
Getting people to pay? No, not at the moment. I mean, you kind of get into trouble when you start asking people for money and you don't live up to the promises and things like that. I mean, there's no pressure on me at the moment. I'd be very careful if I were to go that route, but I don't think I'd do that anytime soon.
How does reporting the news in this way affect the amount of effort you're putting into Formula One? Because tracking news, we know from speaking to Joe that tracking news 24/7 is just impossible for one person, and you need a team of people to do it. Otherwise, you're going to suffer burnout very quickly. Mm-hmm. Has it affected your personal life, and does it make it any easier for you doing things this way, or is it purely just the analysis side of it that really is the reason you're pushing it?
Well, it's more fun because you get to write more in depth about the stories, because obviously if you're going to be pushing stuff out when it happens, speed is key, so you can't get into as much detail even if you have the knowledge and you kind of know what's going on, but you want to kind of research it more. You have to really push it out as soon as it gets into your inbox. But I mean, with me, if a story comes out, unless it comes out in the late evening when everybody's gone home, I can make a few calls and find out what the story is, what the real story is. For me, it's easier because I only have to do it once a day or kind of at the end of the day, as opposed to being constantly glued to the PC screen and writing up and finding out what's happening and everything like that. So it is a lot easier. And much more work-life friendly, so to speak.
That's good to hear. One last question then on this subject, and then we'll move on to other matters pertaining to Formula One. But we did have a discussion, you and I, on Twitter, I think, discussing the value of using tweets from direct sources in news articles. Now, I am for that because I like the idea of getting first-hand information from key sources. So, you know, a driver will tweet something and you can, you know, that's what the driver thinks and that's what's on their mind at the time. I think we were discussing Tony Fernandez's occasional rants he likes to do in the small hours in the morning, you know, picking holes in the other Lotus team. But you said at the time you disagreed with my thoughts that Twitter had value as a news source. What's your thoughts? Can you extrapolate on that in more than 140 characters?
Yes. Basically, Twitter, there's a lot of F1 folk on Twitter, and if you were to be writing stories about everything that drivers and team people say on Twitter, you'd be writing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I mean, I'm not, obviously Twitter is a very good source for getting news from the horse's mouth and so on, but I mean, the point I was trying to make was that people overuse Twitter. They write stories on kind of irrelevant and non-newsworthy comments that people make. I wrote a story on what Fernandez was saying and things like, you know, we're the real Lotus, the usual stuff. But I mean, I thought that was newsworthy. It was he wrote a lot, so there was a lot to take there and a lot to write about. But I find that some websites and some media organizations write full news articles on kind of irrelevant comments and, you know, stuff that they don't know the full story behind. I mean, obviously, as you say, it is a very good source, but I'm hesitant to be writing stories about stuff that's said on Twitter, because there's just so much said, and where do you have to draw the line somewhere? So I suppose I have higher standards than most people, but I feel that there's enough news elsewhere to be able to write about, so I leave Twitter alone usually.
I wonder if it's just a phase that we've never had this kind of insight into drivers' minds and things, so they might say, yeah, I'm having breakfast and then I'm doing this and that is actually quite interesting, but at some point we'll be like, I really don't care. It's just at the moment, because we've never really had that insight before, it's still quite exciting.
I say the biggest problem is that the people who are writing about these tweets don't actually have the insight, the proper insight. You've small websites who've never been to the paddock, who don't actually know what's going on. Usually the tweets that I see are kind of stuff that I know already, so it's difficult to it's more difficult to be writing a story about it, because it might be totally irrelevant given that you know what's going on. So that might be part of the problem, that the people who are writing about it don't know enough to know that it's generic and irrelevant.
Good stuff. Righty ho. I know that this is something you're doing that nobody else out there, certainly in the F1 world, is doing. I think it's very brave. And it's unique and it's different, and I like it, and that's good. We like unique and we like different. Is there anything else that I've overlooked, or anything that maybe you should make me aware of?
No, I think that sums it up pretty well.
Good.
Everything's covered, I think.
Marvellous. We've talked about cricket. We've talked about journalism. We're not quite ready to talk about Formula One, because I think we've got a question about GP2.
I learned today that GP2 Asia is coming to Imola.
That's not Asia.
That's definitely in Europe, or it was last time I checked.
Massively jealous, I must say. I'd love to go to Imola at some stage. I probably will get there at some stage in my life. Fantastic circuit. But yeah, I mean, they had to do something. I think they had one race weekend in Abu Dhabi, and Jules Bianchi, the Ferrari test driver, is on top at the moment. I mean, you can't base a championship around one race weekend, so I think it was definitely the right decision to have another race, and it probably would have been just too expensive to go at short notice to another Asian country or Middle Eastern country. So I think it was probably the right decision in the end to go to Imola. And it's a fantastic track, so it should be great fun for them.
Are you not tempted to try and find a way to get there?
No, I think I'll save my money for the F1 season.
Are you doing that again this year?
Hopefully, yeah. I won't get to as many as last year, but I'll definitely get to a few.
Do you know when your season starts?
At the moment, I think it's looking like Silverstone. I've already booked my accommodation from Monza, so that's a definite as well. And I want to go to one or two others, but we'll see what happens.
Good stuff. I know last time we spoke to you, you were planning on writing up on your blog about your adventures, and you've done that.
I've seen it. It's excellent.
A great series.
Yes.
That's good. Glad you liked it.
You know what struck me from those posts is what very late nights journalists have in the paddock. Do you ever find you're just too exhausted and you don't even want to get up and watch the race?
No. We're there for the race. We always get up. It's at the end of the Sunday night. It's always quite difficult. Your head begins to hurt and you can't write anymore, and you've reached saturation point. But you know, it's, you know, just 5 or 4 hours tough work for a great life. So it's easy to see why people do it full time. Hopefully I'll get there eventually.
So what's the reason for doing less this year? Purely financial?
And time and other commitments and things like that, yeah.
That's a shame, because I did like your insight, and I think it added something to your site. So you're definitely looking at two. Definitely looking at Silver Cinema Monza. And how many more do you think?
I'm not sure yet. It's all up in the air. We just have to see. We take it as it comes. I'm not too sure yet.
Are you still writing for GP Week as well this year?
I think so. I'm not too sure yet.
Do you know when does that start, that magazine season start?
I think it's when the F1 season starts, so that the first issue will be the 28th of March, I think. 27th is the race day, so it'll be the 28th on the Monday morning.
And does that make any difference, the fact that the season is now effectively shorter and starting later? How has the cancellation of Bahrain affected what you're doing and what your plans are?
No, nothing really. Just gives me an extra fortnight to prepare and to get the season preview stuff written and all that, so it's not a biggie. I mean, obviously it's a much bigger issue for the teams. It's probably beneficial to some and less beneficial to others, but it'll all iron itself out in the end.
Do you think Bahrain will show up later in the year at all, or is it off for this year?
I don't know, it's difficult to see. I mean, Bernie is now talking about putting it into the August break, but for the six races that I did last year, I mean, it's quite clear that people do need a break in the middle of the summer, because it's just too tough to be going from race to race from March until November, whenever it is. But it's difficult also to see where else they can fit it in. People have been talking about delaying Brazil by a week and having Bahrain and Abu Dhabi back to back. I mean, Bernie obviously wants to get the race run, because it means an extra $40 million for him. But I'd say the teams would be less willing to sacrifice the August break and the rest of the paddock likewise. So it's a difficult one. Obviously, I'd like to see another race. I don't think there's many people that would say no to an extra F1 race, but it is difficult to see where they're able to fit it in.
How do you think Formula One handled the Bahrain situation? Because it did seem to drag on a little bit. It seemed to take quite a while for the machinations to come together and for Formula One to announce that to take a stand. Do you think that took too long, or was that the right decision in the right amount of time taken?
Well, I think Formula One couldn't have made the decision. Whatever decision it would have been, whether they had said, we're definitely going to Bahrain no matter what happens, or we're cutting the Bahrain race, we're not going to Bahrain, it would have been seen as a political decision. I mean, if they had gone, it would have been in support of the Bahrain government. If they had not bothered, you could have seen it as a support of the protesters, and obviously not supporting the government, who they have the $40 million a year contract with. So, I mean, Bernie did an interview with Formula1.com there today or yesterday, saying that Formula One must not be political. And I totally agree with that. I mean, it's the same with the FIA. They put out a press release afterwards, after the Crown Prince postponed the race, saying that they agreed with the decision and everything. And everybody was outraged that they hadn't made any statement before that. But then a great journalist called Stefan Sampson, I think is his name. He was a journalist. He's the communication director at Renault now. He made an intriguing comment saying that the important part of the FIA press release was in the third paragraph, not the first paragraph. And the third paragraph said something along the lines of, the FIA is the governing body of World Motorsport, in charge of the calendar and safety issues. I mean, if the FIA had told Bernie to go and cancel the race or to push ahead with the running of the race, again, that would have been seen as a political decision, and sport just shouldn't be involved in that kind of thing. I mean, you could question whether did Bernie ring the Crown Prince and tell him to call off the race, or did John Todd ring the Crown Prince and tell him to call off the race? Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. Nobody knows. But I think it was always going to be up to the Crown Prince to decide to cancel the race. It was always going to be cancelled. There was no way that the Formula One could have gone. But it was always going to be the Crown Prince that had to make that decision.
Good stuff. What else has happened since we last spoke? Robert Kubica comes to mind. Thoughts on Kubica and thoughts on Renault, and what do you make of how Heidfeld's now going to have to handle his season? I mean, he's gone from having no drive to having a pretty good drive now. How do you see his season panning out?
Well, he's kind of the Lazarus of Formula One, isn't he? He keeps on retiring and then gets taken back. It'll be very interesting to see how it goes. I mean, Petrov is not considered as a very strong driver, so you could arguably say that Heidfeld should be able to beat Petrov. The main challenge for Heidfeld at the moment is leading the development of the car. He obviously did very well with Sauber, BMW Sauber in 2008, I think it was. Did very well, nearly brought them a title or two, but of course BMW decided to focus on 2009 and then pulled out. But that'll be his main challenge, to develop the car. It's said to be a very strong car, so they should be in the running for a few podiums or race wins. It's widely acknowledged that Petrov would not have been able to lead the development of the car. Heidfeld is very experienced. He's driven a lot of cars. He's got massive mileage under his belt. He's got experience with Pirelli tyres. So it was the obvious decision to go for Heidfeld, given that Kubica will be back in action at some stage, so they didn't need a long-term replacement. So it was a logical decision in that respect. People were saying that Liuzzi is on the market and he's ready to be picked up, but he doesn't have that same kind of experience. He doesn't have the same kind of experience of front-running cars either, so you can see why Renault went with Heidfeld the way they did.
Last time we spoke, you pulled a blinder out of the hat, and you defended Nico Hülkenberg and said, you know, the guy's done a good job and he should be farther up from where he is, and boom, next race, the guy gets pole position, front page news, he's the hero of the hour.
Are you going to ask him to do it again?
Well, yeah, the first question is who should we be watching next? Because obviously you seem to be the man in the know. But the second question is Nico Hülkenberg, he doesn't have a drive. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's kind of indicative of the way Formula One is going. It's gone back to money. And the amount of money that drivers can bring to teams. I mean, when the manufacturers were involved with BMW and Toyota and Honda, and along with the ones that are still there, there was more focus on being able to bring drivers, because there was just so much money there that they didn't have to worry so much about the drivers bringing sponsors. They could get sponsors themselves. So it is kind of, he's a victim of the times that we're living in. He's doing the same thing that Liuzzi did, and obviously De Resta did as well at Force India. The last 2 years, both the test driver has been graduated to the race team, so he's obviously hoping to do the same thing. Like De Resta, he's going to have the Friday morning practice sessions to prove his mettle, so hopefully he can do the business there. The pressure now moves on to Sutil and De Resta, because he's obviously going to be up against one or two of those for the seat for 2012. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to money. I mean, you've got Sutil, who has a sponsorship deal with Medion, some kind of a media company, and then you have De Resta, who is Mercedes driver, and he's in there cutting the engine costs for Force India. You know, what does Hülkenberg have to bring other than performance? You could say the performance is a huge deal, but team needs money to survive.
And talking of teams that need money, HRT. They look like they might be picking up Tonio. Do you have any more word on that? Is he the man for the position?
Well, it's been obvious since Tonio was kind of sacked. Well, I don't know if that's the right word, but he was let go by Force India. I mean, Colin Collar has made a few remarks saying that Liuzzi was the driver he was after. He didn't say it as clearly as that, but that was what he was hinting at. And things have kind of, they've stagnated a bit since. I mean, I think I read something on, was it Joe Sayward's blog or somewhere, that the reason things are stalling is that he's in negotiations with Force India about the contract termination, and if he takes a seat with HRT, he'll lose the money he'd get, or something along those lines. But then if he waits too long for the Force India money, then the HRT drive will be gone. And of course, we got the season coming up in 24 days' time from tomorrow morning. So, you know, things have to kind of move along. The car, the F111, is due to debut in Barcelona next week, so time is kind of running out, but from what I'm hearing, it looks like he will be there. I mean, it's difficult to see who else they'll get in, given that Karthik Kane is kind of short on experience and talent, some would say. So,
would you say?
I don't know enough about him to comment on that, but we'll see. I'll give you a verdict midway through the season.
We won't forget, you know. We'll come back to that.
I'm sure you will.
Can we get technical for a moment? Something that you wrote on your site. I really liked this post. It was entitled, "Why the 2011 Movable Rear Wing Will Work." Now that's quite a mouthful for me to read out. But I thought it was it's an insightful post. The summary of which was, I think, the movable rear wing. It's a perfect short term solution to a short term problem. Can you elaborate more on why this arguably controversial device really is good for Formula One?
It basically, I mean, for people who don't know the how it works, it's basically a wing with the top element that moves to be able to cut off the drag. So it's basically an F-duct that the FIA has control over when they can use it and when they can't. The wing can be used freely in qualifying, so every time you hit a straight or every time you're on full throttle, you bang the button on the steering wheel and the wing moves and you lose drag and you go 15 kilometers an hour faster. During the race, then, you can only use it after the second lap of the race and only when you're within 1 second of a driver in front. So basically, it can only be used then during the race to improve your chances of overtaking. Now, when this was announced back in June last year, obviously I was at the European Grand Prix in Valencia, so I went and talked to engineers and team principals and all this to find out what the story with the wing was. And from what I gathered from that, it will work. There's enough kind of fail-safe measures in place to make sure it does work. The FIA has control over, first of all, the time proximity. So if they find that overtaking is too easy, they can reduce the 1 second gap to, let's say, 3/4 of a second or 1/2 a second. So if the drivers can only use it then when they are within 1/2 a second or 3/4 of a second of a driver in front. They also have control over where it's used on track. My original understanding of the rear wing was that, and this was when the sporting regulation side of it was in its infancy, my understanding was that it would be the drivers could use it whenever they want, so long as they were within a second of the driver in front. They weren't constrained by using it only at a certain point on the track, which is the case now. I think there's going to be one 300 meter section on each track where the driver can use the movable rear wing. It's still obviously going to be that you have to be within the second of a driver in front, but they've constrained it a lot to make sure it's not too easy to overtake. But if it is, as I say, they can change the 300 meters to make it shorter, to make overtaking more difficult, or they can make it longer to make overtaking easier. And likewise, they can alter the time proximity. And a final thing they could do is change the amount by which the wing can move. At the moment, the gap between the two elements can't be greater than 5 centimeters. So if they wanted to ensure overtaking was more difficult, they could reduce that a bit. But that's kind of that would be a last resort, because that requires mechanical change to all the cars, whereas reducing the 300 meter limit or the 1 second limit is electronic. They just flick a switch somewhere on a computer and that's sorted. I mean, from what I was told by, I talked to drivers and I talked to engineers and team principals, and from what I was told, I'm very confident that it will work, but we are likely to see changes to the system over the first couple of races of the year. So if you see in Australia that overtaking is too difficult or too easy, there will be changes to get the happy balance that fans want.
So don't judge it too soon.
No, because I mean, if it is a dismal failure in Australia, there is the capacity there to make significant changes very, very quickly. I mean, you could see a big change in either the time or the length by Malaysia, which is, I think, is it 1 or 2 weeks after Australia. So I wouldn't be too worried. I think it will work. There's been a lot of worry from drivers and all that, but I'm confident that it will work in some way, shape, or form.
We've seen some teams struggling to get a handle on it. In testing, what have you made of the testing that you've seen? I mean, you haven't been out to any of the testers yet, have you?
No, I mean, as I said before, I'm going to save my money for going to the races. I think it's better use of my money, given that races decide championships, whereas testing is just a waste of money. Some websites and some publications out there try and look into the times and say, oh, Red Bull are going to be quick and Ferrari are going to be quick and all this. But at the end of the day, nobody knows. Not even the teams know who's where. I mean, first of all, you've got the fuel load. Second of all, you've got the tyres. And lastly, you've got the weight of the cars. I mean, You might know this, but the there's no rules that govern testing. The only rules that govern testing is that you have to observe red flags and a few other things like that. The technical regulations don't apply because it's private running. So a team could go out there and run a car that's 50 kilos underweight, look mega quick, and still be doing long runs and everything like that. But at the end of the day, when they come to the race, they have to add 50 kilos of ballast to the car. Now, I think Eddie Jordan was famous for doing that he'd tell Gary Anderson to take weight out of the car when he was looking to attract sponsors so his car would look quick. I don't know if any teams do that at the moment, but Sauber did look suspiciously quick in testing last year. That's just a thought of mine. It's nothing concrete, but I mean, it's just so difficult to figure out where teams are from testing. Another thing is that usually for testing, teams run additional sensors and things like that to make sure everything's running okay, and that adds extra weight to the car. But at the end of the day, I mean, the last couple of years I've been following testing pretty well, but I just didn't bother this year because it's so pointless. I mean, I think I made a tweet, or I put out a tweet before testing began, taking a look at Red Bull's performance in testing last year, and I think they topped the times twice, but it was clearly the best car of the year.
Right.
So and again, going back to BMW Sauber, as they were called, they did very well. They were finishing first, second, and third fairly often. But then they at the end of the season down in eighth or ninth place in the championship. So testing is totally pointless. There's no point reading into the times. You just have to wait until qualifying in Australia on the 26th of March.
But even though you can't read anything into the times, do you not find it interesting? Like, for instance, Williams had a lot of technical difficulties and Lotus kept running out of parts and things like that. Is that not interesting to look at?
Well, I mean, that's what testing is for. Testing is for ironing out the issues and everything like that. I mean, the most interesting part of testing would probably be the amount of laps that people run, because that shows reliability and everything. But then again, you have to question, is it in their program to be doing a lot of laps, or, you know, a team that does fewer laps isn't necessarily worse off than a team that does a lot of laps. The spare parts issue, that's obviously a concern for all teams because they're at the beginning of their manufacturing cycle, so they don't have a lot of parts that they would have in the middle of the season when they know crashes are going to happen and they have had the time to build new parts. I mean, we've seen McLaren are off the pace. I think the Hamilton and Button have admitted as such. But there's still a long way to go. We've got 20-odd days to go and there's a lot of development time. It's unlikely that we'll see a McLaren on the podium in Australia. But, I mean, we didn't... A lot of people didn't glean that information from looking at the testing times. It was from the drivers and from the engineers that they learned that. So, I mean, I honestly do not see the point in trying to analyse or even looking at the lap times. I don't bother anymore.
Do you think this extra couple of weeks we have now at the beginning of the season will help McLaren more than the other teams? I know that they look like, or they're making signs as if they are struggling. Will this extra time give buy them enough time to catch up?
I think the main problem they have is that the aim that they had for the downforce level of the car wasn't sufficient to topple Red Bull. I mean, that there was an interview with BBC there that Hamilton did, and he was saying that the car feels really good, it's a lot better than last year, but it's not. It doesn't feel as good as the Red Bull is looking. I mean, McLaren ran into the same trouble in 2009. That was the first year of the new regulations. They had hit their target of the downforce level that they were looking for, but then they went to the first test in Valencia and it was clear that their target was nowhere near the target that Red Bull and Braun had. So they did their job, but they didn't aim high enough, so to speak. And I think that's the same problem again. In 2009, they recovered a bit, but they were starting from a very low base. I mean, Red Bull is a show that they can develop very well in mid-season, so it's difficult to see if they start out as badly as it's looking. It's difficult to see them being able to get back up to speed quickly enough to be able to challenge for the championship. I might be jumping the gun here a little bit, but that's just the feeling that I have.
No, well, we will. I mean, you may be jumping the gun, but we're going to hold you to it. No question.
I'm sure you will.
Everything's on the record.
I'm making notes as we speak.
Something that you've got on your website, RTE. your local broadcaster.
Yes.
They may be looking at taking on Formula One coverage.
Yes, indeed. Fantastic news, and it'd be even better, almost as good as winning, beating England in the cricket if it, if it were to come true, yeah. I mean, I think I was talking to you on the last side pod chat that the audience for Formula One has dropped off a lot in Ireland since it went to the pay station Setanta. No, Setanta aren't going to be running it this year. You probably heard of the trouble with the Premier League and getting the soccer rights and things like that. They've basically run out of money, so they're not going to be doing the Formula One, which is a shame. But if RTE were to take it up, it would be fantastic altogether. I mean, it is one of the, I think it's the third biggest sport in the world behind the Soccer World Cup and the Olympics. So you can see why RTE would want to take it on. But then again, I've read other places that the even Irish people wouldn't be watching it on RTE because the BBC's coverage is so good. But then again, people are comparing the BBC coverage to what ITV had. I mean, the BBC coverage isn't generally the 100% of what is or what people can do.
Yes,
I think as well as that, I was talking to the last time of the coverage that Setanta had, and I was saying that the actual race commentary was miles better than BBC's. Now, this was at a time when Gary Anderson was involved with and David Kennedy when Declan Quigley were on the commentary team. And obviously, Gary Anderson is one of the best designers ever to grace the earth, so he added a lot, but he's with ESPN Star Sports now, so he's not going to be involved. So if RTE could get somebody of that calibre in, I think they could seriously rival BBC's commentary coverage. Unfortunately, they don't have the budget to ever be able to tackle BBC in the post and pre-race features and analysis and all that. But definitely with the commentary, they could definitely challenge the BBC.
You said it's going to be the coverage could come this year. Do you know when that announcement will be? Will it be before the start of the season, or could it happen midway through the season?
I have no idea. I mean, as always, it's money that decides this. The Setanta made the decision quite late not to run with the F1 coverage, so it was after. I mean, RTE haven't budgeted to take Formula One coverage on, so as far as I know, the information that I've been given is that the ability of RTE to pay for the coverage depends on them getting a sponsor in. But then again, I mean, Formula One is one of the biggest sports in the world, so you'd really wonder if they weren't able to get a sponsor why they couldn't. So, I mean, people are confident that the coverage will go to RTE. I'm hopeful. It would be fantastic to get it back on terrestrial television. But until it happens, I remain kind of doubtful.
Happily cynical, but might be a good description.
Mm.
Sir, you have been a star. This time has flown by. So I suggest we probably wrap it up. We wrap it up sharpish, and then we do our best to try and coerce you to come back on this very show.
More than once a year.
Yeah, very, very soon, I was going to say. I don't know if we can squeeze you in before the start of the season, but it would be good to get your feedback after the first or the second race if you were up for doing something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. Sounds good to me.
Good stuff. If anyone's listened to the show and they like what you've been saying, how do people go about finding you on the internet?
Very simply, mf1.ie.
Ooh, I didn't know that URL. Hold on a second. mf1.ie.
It's a special short one. So mf and the number 1.ie, so IE for Ireland.
Okay, I can remember that.
Even you can remember that one.
What a great URL. Okay.
So that's basically it. Or on Twitter, they can find me at manipe f1, one word.
M-A-N-I-P-E. Perfect. Do you have a donate button, or how do people donate to encourage you to go to more races this year?
They can encourage me by visiting the website. I don't have any donating button or anything like that, so tell your friends and everything like that, and I'll be happy out.
Good stuff. Sir, you're a legend. Much appreciate speaking to you. I'm enlightened. I'm educated. I feel slightly bad about losing the cricket, but I'm glad that you're happy about it.
Yes, there's always a winner and a loser, isn't there?
I don't mind being the loser today. Thank you for joining us, and speak to you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.